You are Locked On MLB. Your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans. Welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. Today's date is the 30th day of November. It's the last day of November, and we are going to be paying tribute to three players who call this their birthday. One of them is no longer with us. One of them had a flair for the dramatic in the big moment. And one more is the answer to one of the most agonizing what-ifs in the history of sport. This show is available on the free and easy-to-use Himalaya podcasting app. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're staying at home during these, let's just be kind and calm, odd days, be sure to listen to us on your smart device by saying play podcast Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen. And you can also check out Locked On Yankees with my good friend Stacy Gatsoulias, a podcast which I did a few guest hosting appearances on. Strange, I'm not a Yankee fan, but I guest host on the Yankee podcast. That's how giving I am. Do you understand? You can follow us on Twitter at Locked On MLB Pod. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. And if there are topics that you want me to cover on upcoming Sunday episodes, please send those requests to my Twitter handle, which is Sully Baseball on Twitter. The podcast I did yesterday, we talked about Omar Vizquel's Hall of Fame candidacy and my five wish guests. If I could pick any baseball guests, living or dead in baseball history, who would you pick? And I wound up picking John McGraw, Buck O'Neill, Doc Ellis, Bill Lee, and Joe Garagiola. I think those five would make a pretty amazing series of podcasts. I can't book any of them with the exception of Bill Lee. Do you want? Maybe I'll try to get Bill Lee on here. Maybe I'll try to get him because I can't get Doc Ellis. I can't get John McGraw. I can't get Joe Garagiola or Buck O'Neill because I haven't figured out how to pierce the plane of living and dead. Once I do that, believe me, the first thing I won't be doing is selling Built Bars on a podcast. I will be hopefully collecting my Nobel Prize. And then I'll be doing my new podcast called Locked On Nobel Prize with your friend Paul Sullivan. All right. Three names popped up. I always see who was born on this day. And a lot of times I'll just post it on Twitter or Instagram, like, happy birthday to this, happy birthday to that. Not that I'm thinking that these players are seeing this. And so like, happy birthday, Jason Varitek. I'm not expecting Varitek to be checking his phone and say, oh, golly, Sully said happy birthday to me. I better say thank you back. Nah, that's not what's happening. I just like to do it because it celebrates different players and sometimes people respond saying, oh, I remember I saw this game or that game. It's a conversation starter. It's an icebreaker. And three names popped up today that really, well, I made me sort of pause and say, those are three interesting names to talk about for today's podcast. Now, the first one is, I would say it's the most agonizing what if in the history of sports. It is the birth date of probably in the second half of the 1980s, certainly the most recognizable baseball player, certainly the one baseball player that everybody knew, and the one who had a flair for not only dramatic, but for fun. And he was born in Bessemer, Alabama, on this date in 1962. And his first name was Vincent. That's right. Someone whose first name was Vincent was the most popular and recognizable player in baseball. Vincent Edward Jackson, better known as Bo. Now, Bo Jackson, lest we forget, was drafted by the Yankees out of high school in 1982. He was also drafted by the Angels while he was still a player at Auburn in 1985, all the while he was the best college football player out there, Heisman Trophy winner, all that great stuff. And everyone just assumed he was on his way to a glorious career in the National Football League. And the Kansas City Royals took a flyer on him in the fourth round of the 1986 draft. And to the shock and amazement of everyone in the sports world, he signed with the Royals. And he wound up playing for the Memphis Chicks and did well there and was called up and played 25 games with the Kansas City Royals in 1986. Now, you have to also remember who the Royals were then. The Royals were the defending World Series champions. The Royals had still all the people in place from the team that won the World Series in 1985. They still had George Brett. They still had Frank White. They still had Steve Bye Bye Balboni. And they still had Lonnie Smith and Willie Wilson. They still had Brett Saberhagen and Danny Jackson and Charlie Liebrandt and Dan Quisenberry. And they also had Mark Gubiza. They also had this young pitcher named David Cone, who was a reliever. Didn't really add up to much. So they traded him away for a reserve catcher. And onto this team, who had a disappointing season in 1986. The defending world champs went only 76-86, 10 games under 500. And they also had the devastating news of the health issues of Dick Houser, who had to leave the team midway through, and he died the next year. And just absolutely dead, because he was one of the bright spots, bright managers in all of baseball. But inserted on this team was Bo Jackson. And it was kind of this strange curiosity. Is Bo going to be an actual real player? And that team had a great rookie that year named Kevin Seitzer. But there was a thought of, what's going to happen? Is Bo for real? Is Bo a real baseball player? And then in 1987, his first full season, he wound up hitting 22 home runs. He struck out a lot, but he hit a bunch of homers. And in 1988, he also hit a bunch of homers. And in 1989, he was a 32 home run hitter, 26 stolen bases, drove in 105 runs. Yeah, he struck out a lot. Yeah, by some of the metrics that we use today, he wouldn't be considered an MVP this or an MVP that. But he was a star. And then wound up playing for the Los Angeles Raiders. Remember, they were the Raiders in Los Angeles back then. That was before they moved back to Oakland. And evidently, they're playing in Las Vegas this year. Go figure. And he made everyone sort of was up in arms and said, oh, he was so arrogant that he thought he could just step right onto a football field. He called it his hobby. That baseball was his career and football was his hobby. And all these NFL people put his picture up on the bulletin boards and everything like that. And Brian Bosworth, who was supposed to be the next great big defensive star, was talking smack, this, that, or the other thing. And Bo smoked him and started scoring touchdowns left and right for the Raiders. And then came back and started hitting home runs for the Royals. And it was for a few years there, you had a guy who was fun, charismatic, free of scandal, talked a great talk and walked it. Gave us hilarious commercials. The Bonos commercials were so, they're devastatingly funny when they came out. I have no idea if they hold up, but when they came up and it was just showing that he could do anything. The first one was just him furiously cycling and looking into the camera saying, when's this Tour de France thing? And then, of course, the Bonos, where he was, Bonos baseball, Bonos football, Bonos hockey, Bonos basketball, all this different, stuff that he did. was, he was the most, it just captured our imagination. And then he wound up breaking his hip playing football and came back and hit a home run in his first at bat as a member of the White Sox. And he managed, he had to miss all of the 1992 season, and he played in his only postseason in 1993, where he went hitless in 10 at bats as a member of the White Sox against the Toronto Blue Jays. At one point in game five of the American League Championship Series that year, he came up as the tying run in the ninth inning in the Sky Dome in Toronto. It's now called the Rogers Center. And I remember thinking, this is it. Bo is going to have his signature moment, his postseason moment right here and right now. And it didn't happen. He got retired. He didn't get an entire hit in the entire series. The White Sox wound up losing the playoffs in six games to Toronto. In 1994, he had his final stop where he wound up playing for the California Angels. The White Sox let him go via free agency. He signed with the Angels. He had 13 home runs. He actually wasn't bad. He had actually one of the highest batting averages he ever had and had a decent OPS. And then the strike hit in 1994, and he never came back. And the great what if is, what if he didn't break his hip? What if he didn't need a hip replacement? What if we continued having football, baseball, football, baseball during this wonderful career and just capturing everyone's attention? Like, there's so much emphasis now on kids focusing on one sport. Hell, my cousin Jack has been part of like these baseball camps and baseball year-round training. And I remember there was a period where the star quarterback also played basketball, also played baseball, or in Massachusetts, the star linebacker would be also be a hockey player, that there was a variance in your sports. And now everything's so concentrated, so focused. And Bo Jackson, for that period of time, was the coolest player in all of sports. And there was that sense, and that was the beauty of the Bo Knows commercials, a sense of he could do anything. And with that, we wondered, well, what's stopping us? What is it that we can do? And I miss the multi-sport athletes. And yes, there are a handful. I mean, obviously, Deion Sanders had success in both baseball and football, as did Brian Jordan. You know, going back, you know, whether it's Gene Conley or Danny Ainge, Tom Glavine was a minor league hockey player. You know, Dave Winfield was drafted by the ABA, the NBA, and the NFL before becoming a Hall of Fame baseball player. There are instances of it, but there's never been an instance where someone just dazzled the way that Bo did in the two sports, and that he did it with a flair. Even when he struck out and breaking the bat over his head or stealing the home run in Yankee Stadium off of Jack Clark and just sort of, you know, jumping up and down afterwards. And of course, the single coolest highlight I think I've ever seen in my life was the famous catch that he made in Baltimore, where he ran out to center field, caught the ball, and with the momentum ran up and parallel to the ground, ran up, stepped around the wall, and back down like he was Spider-Man. It just, this was an age when the highlights, you only saw them on SportsCenter. There was no YouTube. And so you had to wait for the sports to come on at 11 o'clock at night, the local news, or you watch SportsCenter. And Bo just always seemed to have a new highlight. Did you see what he did? Did you see how far his home run went? Of course, leading off the All-Star game with Vin Scully, whose birthday was the other day, and Ronald Reagan in the booth at the All-Star game in 1989 and hitting that home run to straightaway center field, the deepest part. Almost nobody remembers the next batter, Wade Boggs, also homered off of Rick Rushel, because his home run wasn't as dramatic and as crushing. So Bo Jackson is still with us, still healthy, still, you know, lives a scandal-free life. You know, there's no books coming out about the dark side of Bo Jackson. I'm sure he's had his ups and downs, as has everybody. But, man, for those few years, really between 87 and 90, Bo captured our imagination. And I think it's difficult for people to understand how someone who, if you examine his stats, you're like, yeah, I guess he had a couple okay years, but what was the big deal? The big deal is he could do everything. Except, of course, avoid striking out. That was the one thing Bo couldn't do. But man, happy birthday to the man who really captured all of our imaginations. And it's his impact on sports and pop culture at the same time really cannot be underestimated. There are two other people whose birthdays are today. One is Shane Victorino. And Shane Victorino, I think, is an interesting player in that he is someone who has, again, like Bo Jackson, had a solid career. I mean, there's nothing to be ashamed of about the career of Shane Victorino. Never a superstar, but a reliable player and someone who had that, you know, he made a couple of all-star teams as a member of the Philadelphia Phillies. And it never was an MVP candidate, never cracked the top 10, the MVP. Was a gold glover, had good solid speed. Lest we forget, he was playing in an era where everyone was pumped up on God knows what, and he would be leading the league in triples. Like he'd be getting, you know, his triples would be in double digits, and he would get 20, 30 stolen bases a year and hit double digit home runs and be in a lineup with a bunch of mashers. And so he would always be on base. But it's interesting that twice in his career, he came up in a postseason moment and hit a critical grand slam. Now, a grand slam, of course, requires other people to be on base. It's, you know, you can't hit a grand slam on your own. And so in the one sense, he happened to hit a home run when the bases were loaded. But in both of those instances, they changed the trajectory of a team that went on to win the World Series. When the Brewers played the Phillies in 2008, the Phillies were not the presumptive World Series champion that year. Everyone thought that was the year the Cubs were going to win. The Cubs had the best record in the National League that year. And there was a sense of, well, the Red Sox won and the White Sox had won. Now it's the Cubs' turn. And the Cubs wound up going on a great run, and Lou Piniella was the manager, and they had made it to the playoffs the year before. The Cubs were the presumptive, I can't even say the word, they were the one everyone thought was going to win. And the Phillies were there. There, people thought the Phillies were good, but nobody thought of them as the can't-miss team. And while they had won Game 1 of the Division Series against the Milwaukee Brewers in a game that was started by Giovanni Gallardo and for the Brewers, Cole Hamels started for the Philadelphia Phillies, they faced the absolute devastating specter of CC Sabathia in Game 2. And everybody and their moose earmarked that as a loss for the Phillies in Game 2 of the Division Series against the Brewers. Remember, the Brewers had rented Sabathia, the defending Cy Young champion, and everyone knew Sabathia was going to leave via free agency. I thought he was going to wind up going to the Dodgers. He wound up putting together a Hall of Fame career with the Yankees. But the Brewers got him. He pitched 17 games. Seven of those 17 games were complete games. Three of them were shutouts. He wound up going 11-2. Again, I'm not a big fan look at the win-loss record, but it gives you a sense that they rode him pretty hard. And he had an ERA of 1.65. And even though he only spent half the season in the National League that year, he was considered a legit Cy Young candidate that year. In fact, he had finished fifth in the Cy Young Award, even though he had pitched 18 games in the American League that year. That was the kind of year he had. And it was the kind of game where you're like, okay, the Brewers are clearly going to win their Sabathia start, which is why it was so critical that the Phillies won Game 1 with Cole Hamels pitching. But the Brewers got an early lead for CeCe Sabathia due to a J.J. Hardy bases-loaded walk. Brett Myers had his – was all over the map. And with a 1-0 lead, that's all you had to do, hand the ball to Sabathia, you got the lead. And Brett Myers was not exactly a Cy Young contender. So it was just thought, okay, the Brewers are probably going to unload on Brett Myers. Sabathia is going to win his game. And that means all the Brewers would have to do was split the next two games in Milwaukee and then hand the ball to CeCe Sabathia for game five. This is what happens early in a series like this when you have a dominant pitcher. And Sabathia had two outs and two on. The Phillies tied the game with a double by Pedro Feliz. And then, stunningly, with two outs and two on, 1-1 game. Okay, Sabathia had a hiccup. He walked the pitcher, Brett Myers, and then wound up walking Jimmy Rollins. And Shane Victorino came up. And a 1-2 count, with Sabathia one strike away of getting out of the mess, tied 1-1, dust yourself, get yourself back off, Shane Victorino launched a grand slam, the first postseason grand slam by a Philadelphia Philly in their history. And suddenly the Phillies were up 5-1, 5-1, as opposed to it being 1-1. Philadelphia went nuts, and in the end, Sabathia wound up walking, you know, it rattled him and he couldn't get out of the fourth. Now, keep in mind, the final score was 5-2. All their scoring was done in that second inning. But Victorino's grand slam turned it into a, all right, Sabathia worked out of trouble and settled down to the Brewers are on their heels. The Phillies wound up winning that game 5-2. Now, the Brewers wound up winning game 3, 4-1, which means that was the split in Milwaukee that they would have needed. Jamie Moyer didn't pitch particularly well, and Dave Bush pitched all right. The Phillies wound up winning game 4, avoiding Sabathia altogether. But that home run by Shane Victorino sunk Sabathia in his final game pitching as a Milwaukee Brewer, and put the Phillies in a situation where they wound up winning the division series, ultimately the league championship series. We got a big home run there, and the World Series against Tampa. Then later, as a member of the Boston Red Sox, he came up when there were two games that were started by Max Scherzer. Two games where Max Scherzer pitched very well against the Red Sox in Fenway Park, and two games where the Red Sox rallied against the bullpen to sink the Tigers. Everyone remembers David Ortiz's grand slam with a cop jumping up and down in game 2. The Tigers are on the verge of taking a decisive 2-0 lead in that series, and Ortiz tied the game, and ultimately Salta Lamacchia won the game in extra innings. Fine. Well, the series went back to Boston for game 6, Red Sox up 3-2. Again, Scherzer pitched well. Again, he got into a little bit of trouble. Again, they brought in the bullpen. And Shane Victorino, who just couldn't hit a barn door with an oar, he was slumping all series, wound up lifting a grand slam just over the wall to give the Red Sox the lead. And there was a lead that they never relinquished. The Tigers wound up losing the game. The Red Sox won the pennant and went on to win the World Series. If the Tigers win that game, it's a winner-take-all game 7, and who knows what the heck is going to happen. But here we go. Two times a World Series champion had a critical pivot on the bat of a grand slam by Shane Victorino, who has two World Series rings for his troubles. So happy birthday to the Flying Hawaiian. And the one last one that I'm going to bring up, he's no longer with us, he died a while ago, and it's probably a name you've never heard of before, but I think one of his great legacies in the history of baseball is the fact that he was a pioneer in some ways, unsung at his time, and was not used in a critical moment. The pitcher's name is Frederick Marbury. He was called Firpo. Why was he called Firpo? Not 100% sure. Firpo pitched for the Washington Senators in the 1920s. Firpo, I just like saying Firpo, Firpo Marbury. This was an age when if you were a pitcher and not very good, they sent you to the bullpen. He was sent to the bullpen. He made a few starts, made a handful of starts, but mainly pitched out of the pen and would pitch 50, 60 some odd games a year and led the league year in and year out in appearances, but would not make a lot of starts. Nobody knew it at the time, but he was leading the league in saves every year. This is when 15, 16, 22, 9 saves led the league. And he would have double-digit wins out of the bullpen. He would be throwing 150 innings out of the bullpen, 130 innings out of the bullpen. He was the workhorse, absolute workhorse, at a time when the reliever was not really looked upon as anything but someone not good enough to start. And along the way, the Washington Senators, sometimes they're printed, they're called the Nationals, sometimes they're called the Senators. I kind of go back and forth. Let's just call them the Senators, call it easy. The Senators made the postseason as the World Series for the first time in their history after years of being awful. And in 1924, he made four appearances, three out of the bullpen. He actually did start one game. The one game he started, he only pitched three innings. Gee whiz, I wonder if they were doing the watch his pitch count. It's a bullpen game. Kind of seems that way. But either way, the games he pitched out of the bullpen, he pitched quite well. He did blow a save in game seven of the World Series, but wound up holding on. He wound up getting a couple other saves, and that was the team that was led by Walter Johnson. Walter Johnson is considered by many to be one of, if not the greatest pitcher of his era, and came out of the bullpen in Game 7 of the World Series that year, which the Senators walked off. Well, that trust in Walter Johnson came to bite manager Bucky Harris in the butt the next year in one of the weirdest games in baseball history. Game 7 of the 1925 World Series. The Senators were looking to defend their World Series title, this time against the Pittsburgh Pirates. And the Pirates were down 3-1 and came back to tie the series. In Game 7 of the World Series, they handed the ball to Walter Johnson, the big train, their big ace, and did so in the pouring rain. Now, the Pirates did have a weird game where they started took their starting pitcher out in the first and then sort of broke it up between Johnny Morrison and Ray Kramer, who combined for 7 2/3 innings out of the bullpen. But it was a wild, sloppy game of which the Commissioner of Baseball was considering just calling at one point when the rain was just absolutely a typhoon. And the Senators were up 6-4 in the seventh. It was an official game. And Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis was saying, "Do you? I'm going to call this. The Senators won. That's it. That's the end of the game." Instead, they decided to keep on playing. And along the way, Walter Johnson, who had thrown a ton of innings and was really, really tired, let the Pirates tie the game in the seventh. Pie Trainer tripled to send home the tying run. He tried to stretch into an inside the park home run, but he was gassed. Walter Johnson had nothing left. And then the Senators took the lead in the eighth on a Roger Peckinpah home run. And here's where Twitter would have blown up in 1925. Walter Johnson didn't have his best stuff. He gave him seven innings, not very strong. And then with two outs in the eighth and a lead, Walter Johnson batted. There was an opportunity, the full bench, full opportunity. Johnson no longer had it. And Firpo Marbury, their ace reliever, was rested and ready. He hadn't pitched for a couple of days. He could have gone the final two innings and saved the World Series. Instead, Johnson popped up. He came out and he got two quick outs in the eighth. So, okay. He circumvented the problem, but then let up a double. Okay, now you got to take him out, right? Nope. Carson Bigby came up and doubled home the tying run. Jeez, you blew the lead. Now you got to take him out, right? Nope. Eddie Moore walked. An error. And then future Hall of Famer Keke Kyler hit a two-run double. The Pirates took the lead. And then one of my favorite footnotes in baseball history, Red Oldham, the most obscure player ever to clinch Game 7 of the World Series, someone who was in the minor leagues earlier that year, retired three straight Hall of Famers, Rice, Harris, and Goslin, and the Pirates won the World Series. And Harris's stubbornness to not take Walter Johnson out and not turn to Firpo Marbury cost the Senators the World Series. And the city of Washington did not see another World Series champion until 2019. So Firpo Marbury, who had a fine career and who wound up pitching in the Senators' other World Series appearance in 1933 and also pitched for the Tigers in 1934 and finished his career with the Senators in 1936, had a good, solid 14-year career. And he didn't make any All-Star games because they didn't really start playing the All-Star game until the mid-30s when he was a bit washed up, but was a pioneer in being a bullpen workhorse. And one that if his manager turned to him in 1925, could have had another World Series ring. So there you go. We celebrate the legacies of Bo Jackson, Shane Victorino, and Firpo Marbury on today's podcast. Coming up this week, I'm going to talk a little bit about the legacy of 2007 and also an article by Kevin Baxter that appeared in the Los Angeles Times this weekend about the Negro League stats and how we should compare them with Major League stats and vice versa. But for now, go to the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app and check out all the different places that you can check out podcasts, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen. This has been Locked On MLB for the final day of November 2020. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.